Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in. Maybe you had the chance to come by KHOI last night and be part of the book reading and book launch. That was with Dennis Malsby, a well-known but local author, and that's just one of the many things that KHOI brings to you. Those kinds of local events that you can participate in and be part of the KHOI family. So you may know that we are in the first week of our fund drive, and we already have raised, what's the number? The number is $23,655 toward our $50,000 goal. So that is awesome for not even the first week. But we would like you to be a part of this fund drive and for you to contribute and join the KHOI family. Currently, we have about 400 folks that are contributing members to KHOI, and we want that to grow. Our broadcasting signal reaches nearly 400,000 people in Central Iowa. So we know you're out there, and we know some of you are listening. So come on and become part of our membership family right now. How do you know if you should do it? If you enjoy the kinds of events we had last night, if you listen to our news and talk shows, if you listen to our music shows, you should become a member. It's easy to join. You can go to our website, khoifm.org, and press the donate button. Or you can call us at 515-292-2878, and a friendly volunteer will take you through the steps of donating or becoming a member. Don't call quite yet. There won't be anyone at the front desk till 9, because we rely on volunteers for that. But you can always do it online. You can also text. The number is for texting is 515-200-7758. Or you can come by and become a member in person, 410 Douglas. We really like to put a face on our membership, so come up by and do that. And that will also give you an opportunity to talk to someone about possibly volunteering as well. Basic memberships start at $55. That's only about 15 cents a day. Or you can donate more. Even better, you can become one of our special friends of KHOI who donate $250 or more. That helps us lay a really solid foundation for taking care of our ongoing operation costs. But whatever you pledge, do it right now and do whatever is right for you. We value your membership. We value your input. We value your participation. Our theme for this fund drive is radio for everyone, and that everyone includes you. So don't hesitate. But let's get started with the show now. And we're going to start off. We've got Dennis Hart with local news.
Thanks very much, Gail. As always, it's a pleasure to be here in this seat on this Friday. Let's start by going back to last Saturday, when one of the most talked about stories was the report that a winning $1 million Powerball lottery ticket that had been bought at a Casey's General Store in Nevada had gone unclaimed for a year and had expired. Iowa lottery officials had worked hard over the past year to find the winner, trying to raise awareness that the ticket was still floating around somewhere out there. But no one came forward, and the deadline passed for whoever bought that winning ticket to claim their prize. A lottery official said it was, to her knowledge, the first time a $1 million prize had gone unclaimed. And just in case you're wondering, after taxes, that winning ticket holder would have taken home a check for $710,000. Also last Saturday, a report on Democratic presidential hopeful Amy Klobuchar's campaign visit to the Lincoln Way Energy Plant in Nevada on Friday. There, the Minnesota senator heard about the concerns and challenges the ethanol industry is facing. She talked about climate change, saying something has to be done, and shared her vision to get universal health care through a public health insurance option. Saturday also brought word that Cook's Emporium on Main Street in Ames had reopened in its original location after a remodeling project that took about 2 months. During that project, the store had temporarily relocated to another spot. Cook's Emporium will celebrate its 40th anniversary in October. And one more note from last Saturday, a feature story about an Ames High School student who is using photography to spread messages about society. Senior student Tiana Sela tries to tell the stories of minorities who have a hidden voice. She says because of digital technology, a meaningful photography collection is a way to make topics non-confrontational. On Sunday, word that Story County law enforcement agencies were focusing on distracted driving during their patrols. As part of what's called Distracted Driving Awareness Month, Ames Police and the Story County Sheriff's Office were collaborating on a You Text, You Drive, You Pay campaign. It's against the law to read or write an electronic message as well as text while driving. A study at the University of Utah reinforced the idea that drivers who talk on handheld or even hands-free phones are just as impaired as drunk drivers. Also last Sunday, a report that Ames police have been carrying a drug that combats opioid abuse for the past year. It's called Narcan, a nasal spray that hit the market in 2016. It helps reverse the effects of an opioid overdose, which can be caused by prescription pain relievers, heroin, and synthetic opioids, by blocking opioid receptors in the brain. Ames police said Narcan has helped save the lives of 9 people who overdosed on opioids. The Iowa Department of Public Health has received a more than $2 million grant to supply all law enforcement officers in the state with Narcan. Sunday also brought a report that Iowa Department of Human Services Director Jerry Foxhoven talked about children's mental health during a stop in Ames. He specifically addressed the progress of legislation regarding children's mental health in the state. Iowa has received a top 10 ranking in mental health in each of the past 3 years, which Foxhoven attributed to the state's focus on its adult mental health services. On the other hand, Foxhoven said the reason Iowa ranks near the bottom on some lists for mental health programs is because of a lack of attention for mental health in Iowa's youth. Crime made news last Sunday with word that 3 people had been arrested after an assault earlier in the week in the 1100 block of Grand Avenue in Ames. The victim was treated and released from a hospital. And police in Huxley arrested 4 people in connection with a shooting incident that had taken place last month. No one had been injured in that shooting. And one more note from Sunday, a story that 2 Story County teachers have been chosen as honorees for the nationwide Iowa Ag Educator Award. Roland Story High School teacher Brad Taylor and Iowa State University professor Robert Martin were chosen, along with 5 other educators in Iowa. Tuesday brought details of the accident that killed a motorcycle driver in Ames on Sunday. The crash took place on South Duff Avenue and South 2nd Street. Authorities said a motorcycle and a car collided. The motorcycle driver was taken to Mary Greeley Medical Center, where he died. He was identified as 29-year-old Kyle Crozier of Des Moines. The driver of the other vehicle was an Ames man. There was also word that the man accused of killing Iowa State University student Celia Barkane Arosamena last September had filed a motion to move his trial out of Story County. The lawyer for the 22-year-old defendant, Colin Richards, wants the trial moved because of what he called the numerous area media outlets that have covered the case since it began. The lawyer believes Richards cannot get a fair trial in the county. Prosecutors say he can. A hearing on the motion to move the trial was set for May 6th. There was also word Tuesday about Wisconsin Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher's visit to Ames, where he spoke about the challenges facing the Republican Party during the 3rd annual Lincoln Highway GOP dinner. Gallagher was the keynote speaker, and he told those in attendance that the party's biggest challenge is a dearth of young people who are Republicans. He said something happened in what he termed the elite levels of our society in the past 20 years, where it became a liability to be a conservative, especially a young conservative. He said more millennials are supporting socialism. Also Tuesday, word that Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley toured a business in Roland on Monday. The business was Innovative Lighting. Grassley said by touring a business that he knew nothing about, he was learning something. Innovative Lighting holds about 100 different patents. After his tour, the senator took questions from employees. One of those questions involved tariffs. The senator said progress was being made and that the goal was to have negotiations with China finalized by the end of the month. He also talked about health care, saying that Medicare is part of the social fabric of the United States, but forecasts about the long-term financial viability of the program concern him. One more note from Tuesday, word that players will get another chance at winning that $1 million lottery prize that went unclaimed for a year. State lottery officials said that from May 29th to June 18th, players will be able to enter a special promotion for the $1 million that went unclaimed after someone won a Powerball drawing at a Casey's General Store in Nevada, but never collected the money. On Wednesday came word that a 17-year-old girl from Boone County had been flown by helicopter to a Des Moines hospital after falling nearly 30 feet from a railroad bridge in Logansport. The girl was with friends when she fell off the bridge after leaning back to rest on a wooden support that was missing. Authorities did not release her name. Meanwhile, Story City officials found out that the cost of repairing the city's historic swinging bridge will be about $127,000. The bridge was damaged by huge chunks of ice during flooding of the Skunk River last month. The bridge is insured, and the city is submitting a claim for the damage. Also Wednesday, word that Democratic presidential hopeful Cory Booker had gone to a house party in Nevada on Tuesday. It was the New Jersey senator's second visit to Story County this election cycle, and he told those in attendance that the United States has, in his words, the worst health care system on planet Earth in regards to medical costs, and said the pathway to Medicare for All begins with Medicare for all who want it, starting with lowering the eligibility age. He also called climate change an existential crisis. Also Wednesday, word that Story County Supervisor Rick Sanders had been chosen as vice chair for the remaining calendar year. This after the previous vice chair, Supervisor Linda Merkin, became chair when Loris Olson stepped down as chair for health reasons. The supervisors also proclaimed April as Sexual Assault Awareness Month. One more note from Wednesday, a preview of a lecture the former president of Mexico was set to deliver last night at Stevens Auditorium in Ames. The title of Vicente Fox's speech, Building Bridges or Walls? Where do the U.S. and Mexico go from here? Fox was Mexico's president from 2000 to 2006 and was known for his role in strengthening Mexico's economy during his time in office. Yesterday brought word that one person had been injured Wednesday night when a small pickup truck went into a ditch and flipped as it was entering Interstate 35 from U.S. Highway 30. The accident took place when the driver of the pickup that was eastbound on U.S. 30 merged into the southbound ramp to I-35 and lost control. The driver suffered non-life-threatening injuries. Also yesterday, word that the Ames City Council had unanimously passed a motion directing city staff to draft language for an ordinance to regulate and enforce licensing requirements for massage therapists and parlors. During the council meeting, 15 members of the public spoke in support of an ordinance to regulate the businesses. In the past 2 years, Ames police have investigated 2 massage service incidents with potential human trafficking aspects. Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, and Iowa City all passed regulations for locally owned massage parlors last year. There was more yesterday, including a report about the 2020 census and how counties are starting to spread the word urging residents to take part. Story County has conducted a response outreach area mapper, which tracks census participation levels throughout the county. Cities such as Ames and Nevada have high participation scores. Census information is used to draw new congressional districts to help ensure that the districts have equal populations. And one more note from yesterday, a story about a feature-length documentary about Ames student Grace McCunn and her fundraising efforts for Blank Children's Hospital. That film recently was shown at the Cedar Rapids Film Festival, where it won an award. Grace is an eighth grader at Ames Middle School. She has raised more than $40,000 for Blank Children's Hospital since she started with a lemonade stand 3 years ago. And there you have it, your summary of the past week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart. Happy to have been here on this Friday and planning to make a return visit on Monday with news from around the state. Until then, Gail and everyone else, have a safe and healthy weekend.
When I was young, I lived in a world of dreams, of moods and myths and illusionary schemes. Though now I'm much more grown up, I fear that I must own up to the fact that I'm in doubt of what the modern cynics shout of. They say it's spring, this feeling light as a feather. They say this thing, this magic we share together, came with the weather too. They say it's May that's made me daft as a daisy. It's May, they say, that gave the whole world this crazy, heavenly, hazy hue. I'm a lark on the wing, I'm the spark of a firefly's fling. Yet to me, this must be something more than a seasonal thing. Could it be spring? Those bells that I can hear ringing. It may be spring, but when the robin stops singing, you're what I'm clinging to. Though they say it's spring, it's you. If poets sing that when a heart's sympathetic, it's merely spring, then poets' plights are pathetic, though I'm poetic too. They say it's spring, for lovers there's where the lure is, that evil thing, for which September the cure is. This they are sure is true, though I know that it's so, that my fancy may turn in the spring with a right one in sight. One can find a perpetual thing. Did I need spring to bring the ring that you bought me? Though it was spring, that wondrous day that you caught me, darling, I thought we knew that it wasn't spring, 'twas you.
Thanks to Dennis for that news update. And the song we heard was They Say It's Spring, recorded in 1958 by Blossom Deary. With rising concerns about environmental degradation and climate action, a focus on Earth Day has started early this year. While Earth Day will officially come this Monday, students, professors, and community members held a preliminary rally in advance at Iowa State, and KHOI's Preston Burris went to it and brings us this report.
This past Wednesday, April 17th, students, faculty, and AIMS residents gathered outside Parks Library in the Free Speech Zone, rallying in protest of the inaction on climate change and celebrating this upcoming Earth Day.
So we are having our Earth Day rally on the Wednesday before Earth Day because on actual Earth Day, the university is putting together a Earth Day tabling event where various student organizations are going to be on campus talking with students about how they can get involved in various clubs that talk about environmental advocacy, conservation, and different initiatives on campus that are happening. All very valuable clubs to talk to, so that's also an interesting event you can go to.
That was the voice of Gabrielle Heidrich, the president of ISU's Climate Reality Campus Core Chapter.
We are hosting an event today, April 17th, on campus, and it is an Earth Day rally to talk about the challenges in Iowa and around the world regarding climate action and environmental degradation, but to also inspire us and talk about the ways that we are making great strides in combating climate change and working to transition to renewable energy systems. We are we're a group on campus that is focused around raising awareness on climate change, educating student body, and also lobbying the administration to commit to 100% renewable electricity by the year 2030. As of right now, the university has made minimal steps towards climate action. They have said that they want to be a coal-free campus by the year 2029 and also reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 50%. But according to the IPCC report that was released last November, that is just not enough for us to combat climate change at the extent that it is ravaging our planet right now. We need to keep climate warming under 1.5 degrees Celsius, or there is, as speculated by scientists, going to be irreputable damage to the environment and to the poor and disenfranchised around the world, first and foremost.
Climate Reality is a national organization dedicated to fighting climate change. I got a chance to speak to someone from the national office about the organization and its goals.
Hi, my name is Emery Kiefer, and I'm with the Climate Reality Project from our national office in Washington, D.C. And the Climate Reality Project was founded after former Vice President Al Gore wanted to create an organization that reflected everything that he had done in the Inconvenient Truth. He wanted to give every single person available the opportunity to speak truth to power about the climate crisis and the solutions that were at hand. And whether that was educating their friends, their families, or going straight to their members of Congress and their other decision makers, at every level, we know that we must be taking action. So since in the past 10 plus years, we've held trainings across the world, have climate reality leaders in 152 countries, and are using three-day trainings with former Vice President Gore to educate on the climate crisis and have the skills necessary to go out and speak about these issues. Our most recent training was in Atlanta, Georgia, where we focused on equity and justice and centering that in our work because we know that the climate crisis disproportionately impacts people of color in marginalized communities. I specifically work with our Campus Core chapters, which is our student groups across the country, to make sure that they're implementing change at the institution level because we know that universities have to be responsible for their carbon footprints as well.
Students and professors spoke at the rally, expressing their concerns about the inaction surrounding climate change and the ticking clock that climate change represents for future generations. This intergenerational tension was centered in the speech given by Danielle Wirth, an environmental activist and professor of ecofeminism at Iowa State University.
Today I am speaking not as a professor, I am here as a resident of Southern Boone County. I am an oil pipeline fighter. I am a water protector. I have biases. I have a bias for clean air, clean water, healthy, thriving, complex soil, and for intergenerational equity. That is, I believe it is your birthright to be able to walk in streams in your bare feet without getting E. coli bacterial infections and rashes. That is your birthright. That birthright has been taken away from you by people who are running and gaming the system. You are the hope you have been waiting for. You are the leaders that you have been looking for. I'm sorry what my generation and past generations have done for you, to you.
During her speech, Danielle drew upon her experiences fighting the establishment of oil pipelines in Iowa.
The Bakken Pipeline is the largest pipeline that we have running through Iowa. It goes from northwest Iowa to southeast Iowa. It starts up in the Dakotas. Allegedly, it was going to be a benefit to Iowa, but right now there's over 580 gallons of Bakken crude, which is erosive and corrosive, flowing through that pipeline. Metallurgy is such that with Iowa's complex soils and moist soils, there's this weird process called cation exchange. There's a relationship and a dance between the chemicals in the soil and the metal in the pipe. And this weak current starts to flow between the soil and the metal pipe.
Another professor, Jay Arbuckle, a sociologist, spoke on issues surrounding the fight to make agriculture more sustainable.
So my name is Jay Arbuckle, and I'm a rural sociologist here at ISU, along with my colleague Betty Wells, who you see right over there. Welcome, Betty. Sociologists. I'm also associate chair of the graduate program in sustainable agriculture here at Iowa State University, and my main focus area is agricultural sustainability. And I work on a lot of sustainable agriculture projects with social and biophysical scientists from across campus and across the country. So I'm here to talk about what I'm passionate about, and that's sustainable agriculture. I hope you don't mind. But at first I want to say a few words about threats to agricultural sustainability and then efforts to make agricultural more sustainable. So it's really important for people to recognize that food security is the foundation of societal stability. And when people are hungry, they get angry, and society breaks down. That's it in a nutshell. And climate change poses real and urgent threats to agricultural sustainability. If you drive around Iowa today, you see soil erosion and soil degradation is widespread. You know, Iowa has some of the most fertile soils in the world, but in many of the areas of the state, we're losing soils and we're degrading soils, and so kind of reducing our capacity to produce food. This soil loss and degradation is made worse by the increasing intensity of rain events as the climate changes. Now, there are many other threats to agricultural sustainability, such as weeds and insects that have become resistant to pesticides and herbicides, degradation of water quality, loss of wildlife habitat. And finally, and perhaps most importantly for today's conversation, is agriculture is a substantial contributor of greenhouse gases that drive climate change. So soil degradation releases greenhouse gases. Use of nitrogen fertilizers can lead to release of the potent greenhouse gas nitrous oxide, which is 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. Oftentimes people don't think about that. And most confined animal feeding operations release major quantities of methane, another very powerful greenhouse gas. So at this point, we're a pretty long way away from true sustainability in agriculture, and this should worry us all. This really worries me.
While the picture he painted was bleak, he did update the audience on amazing strides that were happening at Iowa State to make our agriculture more sustainable and to reduce our negative environmental impact.
I'd like to take this opportunity to say a few things about innovative, sustainable agriculture research and extension efforts that faculty, staff, and students here at Iowa State University are leading. So the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences here at ISU and ISU Extension are leading what's called the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy that promotes the use of nutrient loss mitigation practices and strategies like cover crops and no-till and many other soil and water conservation practices. ISU Agronomy Professor Matt Liebman, who was here a moment ago but had to move on, and his colleagues and students have been conducting long-term experiments that incorporate crops in addition to corn and soybean in extended rotations that can reduce nutrient loss, can reduce soil erosion, and reduce chemical use by up to 80% while at the same time increasing agricultural productivity. A number of ISU soil scientists are conducting groundbreaking research into ways that farmers can improve soil health. Scientists in the Department of Natural Resources and Ecological Management have developed a practice called saturated buffer strips that can greatly reduce nitrogen loss into waterways from agriculture. The Iowa Monarch Conservation Consortium is helping to integrate monarch pollinator habitat and other pollinator habitat into agricultural landscapes across the state. The Prairie Strips Project promotes the incorporation of strips of native prairie vegetation into corn and soybean fields that reduce erosion and nutrient loss while increasing habitat for all manner of wildlife. And the great news is that all of the practices and the systems that I just talked about also have the potential to reduce agriculture's carbon footprint and potentially make agriculture a carbon sink, which is really good news.
The emphasis of the rally was the systemic and infrastructural solutions to climate change. Many speakers spoke about the ineffectiveness of personal solutions to these structural problems. Among these speakers was Mallory Schatz, a student at ISU, who made the case for structural solutions for structural problems.
Okay, so I'm Mallory Schatz. I'm a senior in biology at Iowa State. Currently, I serve as the vice president for Climate Reality Campus Core, and our chapter here is, of course, like all the other 100% committed chapters, we want for the university to devise a plan and to commit to 100% renewable electricity on campus by 2030. And it seems like we are making good progress, not just us, but the university, but we really need more. And I'm very passionate about climate change. We really are running out of time. The recent IPCC report gave us 12 years, so really we have 11 years before we're going to see irreversible damage from climate change. And for years I'd focused on a personal impact, but climate reality and getting involved with the Campus Corps made me realize that change for the better for the environment really is beyond us. It's about policy change and action and activism. And while it's important to lead a sustainable life, we really need to be working together with our colleagues, with our friends, family, students, church members, anybody we can reach out to get to make action happen for the reversal of global warming is essential. Anything's going to happen to save us and save the world.
After over an hour of speeches and chants, with the smell of rain in the air, a group of generationally diverse musicians hooked up their instruments to the speakers outside of Park's library and performed for a small crowd of climate activists and passing students.
Thanks to Preston Burris for that report. One of the things we're doing on Local Talk during our membership drive is to highlight the interesting and varied types of interviews and other segments we have on Local Talk. So for each show during the fund drive, we're putting together what we call audio collages, a collection of excerpts from past shows. Here is a collection of voices from segments that I've done recently on Local Talk. See how many of them you heard on the show. You post a legislative update for the group Iowans for Public Education. You do that pretty much every day during the legislative session. Is that right?
Right. We started about 3 years ago. Iowans for Public Education was started by a lady named Karen Nichols, along with Claire Selsey and myself. And they needed someone to do legislative updates. And because of my background, it seemed like I was the logical person to do that. So we update pretty much every day unless there's just no activity going on.
And all things related to education in
the
legislature.
Yes, we try to keep that limited to education, mostly K-12. Occasionally, we'll do something with the regions or the community colleges as well.
Before we delve into the particular bills that I'd like to talk about, explain to us how you do that. How do you keep track of everything? I mean, I've been so impressed when I read your legislative update. I just think, how does he follow all of this?
I spend a lot of time online, just reading the bills. The bills are all published daily as they're introduced, so I can just watch that. I've learned over the years, you know, to watch for the different committee meetings and know when committees are meeting. And then I have a variety of contacts around the state from my previous work, and they help keep me informed as well. And it takes, you know, 2 to 3 hours a day of just watching and reading and updating.
You were able to go to the launch. So tell us about that. Where was the launch site and what was it like?
So the launch took place about 2.5 hours up the coast from Los Angeles at the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. We headed out to L.A. and drove up, and there were a lot of people heading there just for this launch from around the world, really. It's an international project. So there are people there from France and Germany and England and all over the U.S.
Yeah, it was at 4:05 a.m., the launch. And it was the first interplanetary launch from the west coast of the United States. We've always launched from the Florida coast in the past, Mars missions. So on the west coast in the morning, turns out that certain conditions created themselves where there was a very, very, very thick marine layer of fog.
Unfortunately, Mother Nature really was impressive that morning. And even from just 8 miles away from a massive rocket taking a spacecraft to another planet, we could not see one single ember or glow of light.
Wow.
What we did get to experience was the sound. Still pretty cool. Fog couldn't block the sound, so we in the crowd heard the audio countdown of, you know, all the systems and checks and readiness. So we heard the countdown. We knew via the loudspeakers that it had gone off, and so we were waiting expectantly. Can't see anything, and I'm not sure how many seconds later. It was quite a delay, which shows you, it's just kind of cool to really experience how slowly sound
changes. Yeah, uh-huh.
Then we finally heard this big rumble, and can you kind of feel it in your chest a little
rumble
bit?
Rumble slash crackle.
Yeah, rumble slash crackle is a good way to describe it.
The Inside Out Reentry Community was founded in late 2014. It was originally a project of the First Baptist Church of Iowa City, and then went on to later become an independent nonprofit in late 2015. Our organization supports individuals that are involved in the criminal legal system. So it ranges from individuals that are still incarcerated, people who've been recently released from incarceration, as well as individuals who've been out in the community for quite some time but are still facing the same barriers that they would face right after they're being released.
Just focusing on people who are coming out of prison and reentering society, what obstacles do those people face? What are some of the main obstacles that they face?
It was estimated, there's actually someone who put a number to it, and it was like 40,000 different barriers. And, you know, a misconception that I like to dispel is that actually 95% of all Iowa prisoners will be released from prison. So most people are being released, more than not. And some of the major barriers facing individuals is employment, housing, and overall social stigma. After incarceration, I saw a recent study that showed that individuals are 10 times more likely to be homeless than the rest of the population. And so there are some really major collateral consequences after incarceration, particularly around housing, employment, with, you know, a lot of landlords that will refuse to rent to anyone with a criminal background, regardless of the circumstances or length of time since the conviction. And we see that the same with employers. It's very challenging because, you know, you have to provide for yourself. You have to have money. You have to live somewhere. And those are some of the most basic needs and some of the biggest struggles for individuals.
Since 2017, since January of 2017, there has been an increase in activity, which includes surveillance, harassment, detention and deportation of immigrant families across the state of Iowa. So I'll just give you a background on how I know this information. So basically, I have worked with immigrant rights advocacy in the state of Iowa since I got to the state. In the last year, I was able to collaborate with a few Latina women in the Des Moines area to create a tool to basically provide some sort of resources and aid to the families that will be potentially impacted by immigration customs enforcement activities. And so this tool is a hotline. And so this hotline is used by folks that are reporting, you know, surveillance, like I said, harassment, detention, and deportation of their loved ones, of something they saw, an activity they saw. We've been able to filter out in the last year a report of things that were activity that people just saw outside in the street and actual detentions and deportation of family members. So we are able to connect with the family members of those that have been taken away. And most of the folks that have been taken away happen to be fathers. They are all males. They are all fathers of actually U.S. citizen kids. The fact that that is going on in Iowa and nobody's talking about it, you know, that's why I'm really thankful for you to actually open up this discussion, because it is happening right next door of us and Iowans don't know about it. And it's important to talk about it.
Recently, I've been wondering about my grandma's story, my dad's mom. She is Japanese and lived in Japan during World War II. After the war, she married an American soldier. I really wanted to know what her family thought of her relationship. Did they approve of my grandpa? Did they trust him? To get the answer, I sat down with my grandma at my aunt's house on Thanksgiving.
So you have to question to me,
mm-hmm.
So I have to answer.
Yes. She told me about her life, about living in Japan during World War II, and meeting my American grandpa. She also told me about becoming a citizen of the United States. We're sitting in a room upstairs. It's empty, except for a dresser and a couch. My cousin's kids are playing in the hallway. She sits on the floor cross-legged, a small Japanese woman with short brown curled hair, and a tissue in one hand. Kimio Sakai was born in Ashikaga, Japan. Ashikaga is a city an hour and a half north of Tokyo. She was born in Showa 7. This is the Japanese date for 1932. The dates are based on the emperor at the time and how many years he was into his reign.
And I was 11 years old, United States and Japan.
Japan entered World War II December 7th, 1941, with the attack on Pearl Harbor. My grandma was actually 9 years old at the time. She started telling me what she remembers from that time in her life. She remembers how her house changed, how her siblings were sent off to help war efforts, and about her time in school.
I can see the sky. It's an American airplane bomb.
Those were voices from some segments that you may have heard on Local Talk. The speakers were, in order, Randy Richardson, who provides online updates on education legislation in Iowa, Abby Seiler, my daughter, and Kevin Gilligan, talking about attending a recent NASA launch in California, Michelle Hines from the Inside Out Reentry Community, Maria Alcivar, talking about ICE activity in Iowa, and Sam Patterson with the podcast she produced about her grandmother called Loving the Enemy. These audio collages highlight the theme of our fund drive, Radio for All. And by all, we mean that we have segments that appeal to a wide variety of interests among our listeners, and also that we put many different voices on the airwaves. So if you value that and want Local Talk and KHOI to carry on with that, then you should make a donation or become a member. Just go to our website, khoifm.org, or call 515-292-2878. After 9, or come by the station at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames. We would like to include you in the KHOI family. And you're listening to KHOI with Local Talk today. I'm your host, Gail Seiler, and we've been joined now in the studio by Alex Fafar from the Ames Historical Society. Good to see you today.
Thank you for having me.
It's the 50th anniversary of C.Y. Stevens, so we're going to be talking about that. But I think first you're going to give us some history kind of on that whole area and how C.Y. Stevens even came to be.
Yeah, I thought we'd talk a little bit about the history of the Iowa State Center, just that area in general. Because I think, you know, obviously that's an area that has some large buildings in it. It's kind of wide open. And if anybody that's lived here in 1993 or 2010, kind of, I think, knows why that's been wide open, was wide open for so many years. It's in a big floodplain here in town. So people shied away from developing on it for a long time. But an interesting fact about that, when it was a wide open field, maybe some of you are familiar with Nita Snook, who was a female pilot in the Ames area in 1920s. And she actually went on to later teach Amelia Earhart to fly. But before she did that, she was barnstorming in the Story County area, and she used the floodplain there as her airport. You know, we got to remember there was no official Ames airport back until 1945. So it's kind of a little fun prehistory of that area. But I think the interesting thing with the Iowa State Center developing in there is it's also the same time as the Highway 30 bypass was getting developed too. So prior to that, Lincoln Way was the main highway through town, which really got congested. And so in the late 50s, they're working on projects to bypass towns, get four lanes for everybody going every direction. And so there's some fun. If you look at some of the maps of the city of Ames from back in the mid-60s, while they're trying to put out city maps that students can use to get their way around town, they're putting some of these proposals for the projects on there. So if you look really close at a few of those, you'll see, like, instead of having what we know as University Drive today is the main road up that, the main exit,
like
there,
perpendicular to Lincoln Way.
Yeah, running north off the highway there. There were proposals to connect it to South Riverside Drive on the other side of Squaw Creek, which would be kind of interesting. I live over not far from that neighborhood, and I couldn't imagine if the main road was going through there. So it's kind of fun to look at some of those maps and see, like, what was happening at the time and what eventually came to be, you know, when they built this thing and eventually decided to go kind of a little more towards beach, but not totally link up with beach and get Elwood Drive, which I'm sure you still remember Elwood Drive being in town, Gail?
No, I only moved here 5 years ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I moved to town in 2007, and I got to enjoy Elwood Drive for about a year and a half, I think, before
so
it got
renamed. So explain what that was.
So that was University Drive. Okay. In 2000, that was its original name was Elwood Drive after Philip Elwood, who is a landscape architecture professor for, I think, 27 years on campus. And so they named that road in his honor, like many roads in that area are named after mm-hmm. Iowa State professors. But the university, with its 150th campaign, when 2008, when they turned 150, they wanted to kind of make the street be more reflective of the entrance to Iowa State College
right.
that it is today.
Okay.
So they put up those big brick signs kind of near Ryman Gardens and rebranded the road as University Drive
so
from Elwood.
Professor Elwood kind of got demoted. He got the road taken away.
He did. I think he still has a dormitory okay. level named after
okay.
him. I think I've seen that on a building. So I don't think he's without anything named after him. But
so they decided to build on that floodplain regardless of the fact that it was a floodplain.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Build this huge, big complex that we now have five buildings on. And here, I'll throw another little quiz question
okay.
at you. Of the buildings all in the Iowa State Center, do you know which one, excluding Jack Trice Stadium, which one is not named after a major donor? Any guesses?
No.
It is Hilton Coliseum is actually was named in honor of James Hilton, the former president of Iowa State, because this was actually the whole center idea was his brainchild.
So he's not a donor.
He was not a donor, but it was named in his honor because of it was his
okay,
idea or
okay.
he was really pushing it forward.
Hilton.
So
all right.
he proposed this idea in 1954. And in 1958, ISU Foundation was formed with the primary goal of raising funds for the construction of the Iowa State Center. And it's working on raising over $800 million in donations. Now, there was no funds. The state did not appropriate any funds for the construction. And this is a fun fact that I like too. The first donation to the project was $2 anonymously from a person. Then followed by a second donation of $1 million by C.Y. Stevens, which I'm sure you're familiar with at C.Y. Stevens Auditorium. And I think some people, if you're not from town or haven't lived here for a while, the CY does not stand for the mascot either. Like some people think it might. It was Clifford Y. Stevens.
So it's just coincidence.
Just a coincidence. And it's hard to leave it off the building if that. You got to use his middle initial if it's CY, right? So the building is not named after the Cardinal, but a former ISU alumnus that contributed to it. So yeah, we're going to hopefully, you're going to find out a lot more about the CY Stevens building when we have our lecture next Wednesday, April 24th at 7 p.m. at the Ames Public Library. And this is going to be all about talking about 50 years of Stevens Auditorium. So it's going to be presented by Tammy Kolbeck, Executive Director of the Iowa State Center. And I think she's going to do a wonderful job talking about some of the, you know, well-known stories. Obviously, some people, if you're living in town, you know some of the people who are coming through and doing concerts like Elvis and Whitney Houston and people like that. But maybe some of the behind-the-scenes stories that you've never heard before that you'll want to tune into. There's a great quote from an Iowan who entered C.Y. Stevens Auditorium for the first time to hear the New York Philharmonic was the opener. And he's quoted to say, "It's a hell of a hall for a cow college."
Classic Iowa response.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so 1969, C.Y. Stevens opened, and we've been enjoying great, you know, orchestras, performances for 50 years here in town. I'm curious, Gail, have you ever seen a show at C.Y. Stevens or have a favorite?
I've only seen student performances there.
Yeah. Like of what variety?
Concerts.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Like I think I often go to choral concerts and I think some of them have been there.
Ah, nice.
I haven't really gone to any of the big Broadway shows that come through or anything like that.
Yeah. Well,
sorry.
The
I'm
closest thing
I
think I've been to, I think it was on Broadway. But I went and saw Young Frankenstein there a couple years ago. Big fan of the Mel Brooks movie. So that was really good and wonderfully done. I've seen a few other shows like Bob Dylan came to town last 2 years ago, I believe, two mm-hmm. Octobers ago.
Right.
That was a great show.
I remember hearing about that.
Yeah.
I didn't go to that.
I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan, so that was not my first show, hopefully not my last
So you
either.
Went to that?
I did go to that one. That was a great show. So it's a wonderful auditorium just being in that. And I even used to work at the Sheeman Building as an Iowa State student doing event setup and stuff and stuff like that. And one of my jobs was we had to roll over our dirty work shirts over to C.Y. Stevens because I guess they had the only washing machine in the complex. And we'd have to roll them across the stage. So every once in a while, I get to take a little five or ten minute break in the orchestra pit, just sitting down there in an empty Stevens auditorium, which is kind of fun.
So what are the five buildings?
Yeah, maybe we should mention that.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll start with the biggest, Jack Tri Stadium. And that was completed in 1975. And that cost over $7 million to build and can seat over 61,000 in there. So, and Iowa State classes have gotten so big that I believe now they have graduations at Jack Tri State. They can't even fit in Hilton anymore. Then we get to Hilton Coliseum. So that's obviously named after James Hilton. It's not sponsored by Hilton Hotels. And that was built in 1971. And that cost a little bit more, $8 million. I believe they can seat almost 15,000 in there. Stevens Auditorium, like we mentioned, in 1969, that was the first one to get complete.
Okay.
So that kind of started the center off. And that cost almost $5 million, and they can fit almost 3,000 people in there. And we also have its little brother to the north, Fisher Theater, which was built in 1975 for just under $1 million. And that only seats about 450 people. I don't know if I've ever been in Fisher Theater.
See, I've been to that one a number of times because that's where they have student plays.
I've
seen a
smaller
number of
numbers
and
in there. Yeah.
Yeah, really, really good performances by students.
And the last one I was forgetting was the Sheman Building, which they held, you know, a lot of conferences and weddings and events and stuff like that there, and also houses the Brunier Art Museum. And that was in 1975. That was completed for $5 million. And I should say, for the Stevens Building, I forgot to mention, that was awarded. It was the Building of the Century Award. Back in 2004, it was given that title. So a great honor for that. And it's, you know, it's certainly a building with a skyline that sticks out in Ames.
Mm-hmm.
It's one you really notice and can see that as you go by there.
So not necessarily the stadium, but the others, you know, that kind of form a collection up at the north end of that area. They seem to have a similar style of architecture. Do you know anything about the architecture of them?
I do not. If they were all designed by the same person, they're all mostly concrete-based, formed concrete. So I'd imagine they're all going on at the same time, and a lot of them are being constructed at the same time.
Simultaneously
okay. at the same time, too.
Yeah.
So I would have to look into that more.
I once heard that kind of architecture described as brutalism.
Brutalism?
And that's an actual architectural school. And I think it's the style that those buildings are.
Like playing in with using concrete and things that are not as what we call like nice finishing touches that you'd see in a normal place.
Yeah, yeah. The walls even inside are rough and so on.
Yeah,
and
no wallpaper.
And it's actually a type of architecture. So I'm not sure about that, but that's my relatively uninformed hunch.
We'll go with it until we hear.
We can look that up. We can look that up.
Yeah, we'll have to.
Right. Okay, so this is interesting. Do they still have problems with flooding in that area?
You know, I think they've done a lot. You know, obviously, Hilton Coliseum is probably the building that's had the most damage done to it because it is, I believe it's a little sunken in the ground. It's not totally like Iowa City's basketball, Carver Hawkeye, which is totally like buried in the ground. But I think they've done a lot more with the floodgates and things like that. I know the 2010 flood just hit so fast and unexpected that they thought they had more time to get things like that in. So
yeah.
I think they've taken a lot more steps to make sure that they are more prepared and can get ahead of it. And I think this is on YouTube somewhere. I've seen videos of it when it happened, but if you've look for a video from 2010 of Hilton Coliseum and you'll see the basketball floor floating in, I don't know, 5-6 feet of water or something like that. And they just look like tectonic plates kind of on top of that.
Pieces.
Yeah. Some of it's together, but there's clearly it's like gaps and you just see the waves of it go through. Search that out if you've never seen that before.
All right. Good tip. So, Alex, before you leave, you know it's our fun drive now, so I just wanted to ask you a quick question.
Sure.
What does the Historical Society value about KHOI?
I think KHOI is great because it's local. Like, you can tune into IPR and NPR. Those are wonderful, and you're going to get some great news about Iowa and maybe some good news about central Iowa and Ames because we are close to Des Moines. But there's nobody talking about local Ames politics, local Ames events, having local Ames people on the radio. You know, ever since we've lost WI Radio back in the 90s, we lost that voice. And I think having KHOI come back to the air has brought that voice back. And it gives people a platform and a place to express themselves artistically with music and control and setting up shows, but also the whole community aspect of it. It is. I mean, it's community radio, and that's really hits at the heart of it.
All right. There you have it, an historical perspective on why you should become a member and donate to KHOI. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. And I'll say the date for that lecture again. It's April 24th. That's next Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Ames Public Library Auditorium. And you can also check out our current exhibit, Exploring Unique Ames, photo selections from the Farwell T. Brown Photo Archive. That's on display at 416 Douglas. And we're open Tuesdays through Saturdays, 10 to 4.
Got it. Thank you. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday and Wednesday, and 7 a.m., noon, and 5 p.m. on Friday. You can also listen to our shows on our website, khoifm.org, and that's a place that you can also donate and become a member. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards, and we also heard They Say It's Spring by Blossom Dreary. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend. Remember, your participation is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful, and that's especially true during our fund drive. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.